That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. One of the joys of being a fan of the horror genre is tracking the careers of promising filmmakers working within it. It's especially fascinating to discover exciting new voices from different corners of the world. It's exciting to discover a little gem in Sitges, Spain, for example, from a Norwegian filmmaker, for example, and see his career blossom and be recruited in the U.S. by the major studios. A lot of our most successful filmmakers got to us by way of smaller-scale films from other nations. I first met Guillermo del Toro at a screening he had set up for me to see his film Kronos when I was about to shoot The Stand. He did that so that I would consider the film's now Oscar-winning director of photography, Guillermo Navarro, to shoot the miniseries. Well, that didn't work out, but it did introduce me to an exciting original voice in genre cinema that I would never have known about if I had stuck to my local Cineplex. And to see Del Toro's career flourish into huge success and Oscars warms my heart. Sweden's Thomas Alfredson went from Let the Right One In to Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and the Snowman. Japan's Hideo Nakata went from Dark Water and Ringu to big-budget Hollywood studio remakes of the same movies. Britain's Neil Marshall went from Dog Soldiers and The Descent to Lost in Space, Game of Thrones, and Hellboy. Spain's Juan Antonio Bayona went from the nightmarish The Orphanage to The Impossible and A Monster Calls. Australia's James Wan went from Tiny Little Saw into an entire industry unto himself. Scandinavian countries have given us a huge assortment of high-quality horror, Night Watch, Rare Exports, Dead Snow, and many others. But my very favorite is the brilliant faux-found footage extravaganza Troll Hunter, written and directed by André Ovredal. He followed that up with his first English-language film, a little movie called The Autopsy of Jane Doe, one of the creepiest, most mysterious, and original horror films of the last several years. And now, André is on the verge of the release of his first major American studio film, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, produced by Guillermo del Toro himself. We'll talk about that journey through an exciting burgeoning career with André right after this. So, you think being a private eye in a decaying city on the East Coast in the 1920s is easy? When your city is chock-full of criminals, cultists, Innsmouthers, witches, and Cthulhu knows what else? Well, it's definitely not. Dive into The Sinking City, an investigative adventure game set in an open world inspired by the universe of H.P. Lovecraft, the master of horror. The half-submerged city of Oakmont is gripped by supernatural forces. You are a private investigator, and you have to uncover the truth behind what has possessed the city and the minds of its inhabitants. The Sinking City is now available on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC. In 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. It's been 40 years now, and Fangoria is better than ever, each issue bringing you 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horrors past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give anything away because we want the experience to be a surprise, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and to, well, subscribe. And while you're there, make sure to enter the promo code POSTMORTEM to save 15% off your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, promo code postmortem to save 15%. So where did it all start for you? Were you a genre fan as a kid in Norway? How did it all come together?
Oh, absolutely. I was a huge fan of the horror and, sci-fi genre and anything that is spooky and weird. I was scavenging the video stores for titles that nobody else would want to see.
What were some of those that you sought out that impressed you?
I mean, movies that I... There were so many little movies that were called Retribution or Witchboard or these kind of things that nobody really knew about. And then there was obviously the great ones like The Exorcist and The Omen. And, you know, and I remember seeing The Omen, for example, on a VHS tape. That was my first experience with it. And the VHS tape was so bad and it was pan and scan. Right. But it made it actually so grungy, you know, and dark and sinister as a viewing experience that when I saw the Laserdisc a few years later in, you know, beautiful widescreen, it was almost like it had a negative effect on me.
Because it didn't feel so forbidden to you.
In a way, yeah.
So kind of back alley viewing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Were your parents supportive of your interest in the genre?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were supportive of me being interested in films way before I started making anything. I remember I grew up out in basically the wilderness, and there were no cinemas there. So my main thing was through TV and VHS tapes. So I remember my parents bought a VHS player in the early 80s.
Right.
And that was like, and suddenly I started getting a hold of movies and also illegal movies. There were like famous movies like Evil Dead was not legal in Norway at the time.
Really? So it had the equivalent of a British X certificate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it wasn't even imported. So I had to, when I got a hold of a copy of it, it was like a huge thing, you know.
So VHS was your launching pad. Did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker, that it was even possible to become a filmmaker when you were a kid? Did you make little home movies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my uncle had a Super 8 camera, and I started filming little things with that.
So you shot on film first?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And then I bought when I was like 15, I bought a video camera. At 15, I bought one that was pretty decent. And then I started shooting action and horror movies with my friends all summers and years, all the next years. I made a feature film called about a guy who gets possessed by a Ouija board. Mm-hmm. That was when I was like 15, 16 with my neighbors. And we found this house that was just empty, and we shot the whole film in there and then, you know.
So were your friends who you made the movies with, were they film fans too, or was it just fun for them?
I mean, my best friend who I made that movie with, he was playing the lead, he was definitely a fan of the genre. But, you know, it was fun. Somebody was doing something, and it was fun. Right. And I had another neighbor who was shooting his own little horror film. So it became this little weird community among houses of 20, 30 20, 30 houses.
Right.
And there was like two groups of people making little films there.
So you didn't even have a film theater in your town?
No. So I had to go to Bergen, which was the biggest town in the neighborhood, and it was like a half-hour drive. And we didn't really, you know, so it wasn't really like a thing you just did on a daily basis. Right. It was like a whole trek to do it. And it would be a movie that I would, you know, really want to see.
Did you study film at all in school or anything? There's not a whole lot of biographical material about you available, so I'm just kind of searching to see. Did you go to film school? Was there? What was your education? Was it entirely a self-educated thing?
No, I mean, I shot movies for years that way. But then when I was 19, I went to Santa Barbara and I went to film school there.
Oh.
So I spent
UCSB?
A school called Brooks Institute.
Oh, I know the Brooks Institute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they do photography as well.
Yeah, no, it's mainly a photography school, and then they have a film department. So,
yeah, Shelley Johnson, my DP on The Shining and Quicksilver Highway, had taught photography there.
Oh, yeah, how funny.
Really a fantastic place. I had no idea you went to school in California.
Yeah, no. So I've been, I had many years here. I spent 5 years. I lived for a year in Burbank afterwards.
Ah.
Worked at a place called Photochem Lab.
Oh, yeah. The late, great Photochem. Back when there was film.
Yeah. I remember I worked in a storage facility there at night for a year. So
it's interesting. So you went back to Norway.
Yeah.
After being in LA for years. And the first feature film that brought attention to your work was very Norwegian. I mean, it is steeped in the legends of the community with Troll Hunter. So how did you get the opportunity to turn that into a feature film, something that would play around the world?
I mean, that was obviously an unbelievable series of events that always is when you have, I mean, it's sheer luck, unfortunately. It's a lot of luck. I had an idea that I'm very proud of about the Troll Hunter, that very core idea, and I developed that for years, just, you know, doodling. And then a DOP I was working with on commercials said, you got to go and see this producer about this idea. And he set me up with a meeting with basically the biggest producer in Norway, who was Academy Award nominated some years earlier. And I pitched it to him in a room, I had a 3-page document, but I said like 2 sentences of what it was about, and he just started smiling. He was like, this is the best idea I've heard in years. We're going to make this movie. And he was like, okay. And then he made one phone call, John Jacobson is his name, and he made one phone call, and he got a distributor in to finance half the movie. And then just based on the pitch. And then we took 2 years to get the Norwegian government to give us the rest.
Hmm.
But that was also entirely based on his position in the community,
right,
that they would entrust him with this money for this movie, because it was a very weird movie at the time in Norway.
Well, it's a weird movie now. But what's great about it is a sort of found footage movie. But when you think of found footage movies, normally they're done because they're cheaper than anything else, if you can use some ingenuity. But this has unbelievably high production values, the locations, the trolls themselves, the CG work in it is extraordinarily rich and full and good and not cheap, I'm sure. So tell me about how that concept came together for you.
I mean, the big thing, and that also feeds into Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark right now, is that at that time I had, you know, Norwegians know what trolls look like. What they don't know at the time was what they sound like and how they move and how they behave. But we have like these drawings that were in a fairy tale book that was written in the 1800s, and that's how Norwegians see their trolls, huge creatures of nature with long noses, maybe 3, even 9 heads at worst, you know, and
oh, wow,
they're kind of nutty looking. So I had to really stick close to that design. And I wanted several creatures in the movie. I wanted to be like a world rather than just a monster. So and I wrote several drafts of the script because I couldn't figure out I wanted the film to be very simple and not be about anything but discovering the world of the trolls, basically.
Right.
So I had to figure out a way to focus on that and not let other plot elements eat up the screen time. So that became a big thing, and it took me a couple of years to do that. And then eventually we shot it in 2009, and we were shooting very raw and unplanned in a way, because that was the way it had to be. Whenever I tried to direct a scene in that movie, like you know, really like normal direction in a way,
right,
I had to, it didn't work. It just played like a movie in a way. It just played like a, it felt staged, it felt this, it felt, you know, it felt negative.
Right, right.
In the context of what this movie had to be. So I had to totally learn to step back and just discuss everything with everybody and let them do it and let them improvise and go back and roll takes again and again and again.
So it wasn't originally a found footage format that you'd had?
Yeah, no, it was.
But you just loosened up how you...
Yeah, I had to just, in the way of directing it, I just had to do it in a different way than I'm used to. I've been directing commercials for a decade before I made the film.
And commercials are so specific
in
every
detail. Yeah, that's super precise.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, way too precise in a way for a feature. So to try to make that work, to make that film work, I learned to have to not be... The movie couldn't have the stamp of a director, basically. It was a weird thing.
So you had to step back.
Yeah, really had to learn to step back and let the actors and the camera operator and everybody work it out and random. And we would change it up the way we shot it all the time. Every take would be different in a way.
Well, what was the most complicated part of that? I know you're working with visual effects, with characters that aren't there when you're shooting. So did you use a green ball on a stick, or what did the actors interact with?
Yeah, absolutely. The green ball, we had one that was 30 feet high, you know, that was with a green ball. Okay, that's where you're, you know, look up there. That's where you're... that's where the eyes of the troll is. Right. And I would stand there and I would out in the field and I would be screaming what the troll was doing to the actors, like as loud as I could. And okay, run, you know, and because I had to create a sense of panic with absolutely nothing going on.
Right. Now, this wasn't your feature. Was it your first commercial feature? You had done like when you were a teenager, you had done one on Super 8, but had you done anything theatrical before this one?
No, that was my first. I've done some short, like real shorts, but
right.
Not much. I mean, it was I kind of jumped directly from commercials to this one.
Right, and so. Budgetarily, what was there anything that you weren't able to do in the film that you wanted to do from its plan? Because it looks like everything is there. It's everything you wanted it to be.
No, I mean, like the final act, which is basically up on some mountain plateaus, and there's this huge troll that comes. We had a much bigger scene there, and we just realized that we had to just condense it. So the DOP and I sat all weekend before... that the shooting of that sequence was supposed to begin, and we just had to condense the script. Okay, that we can do, that we can do, that we can't do. We won't be able to find the time to do that, so we have to get from there to there. It was and we rewrote the script, the action of the thing, of the piece, basically.
Once you were into it already?
Yeah, when we were in depth, and we basically knew how fast we could shoot.
Right.
The only way, we shot that film in 28 days.
And wow.
And the only way we were able to do that is because with found footage, you only have one camera. You know, right. You only have one angle on everything. You're not cutting to a new angle.
Right.
You don't have to do coverage. You can't.
So you're
do
not
coverage.
Covering it from eight different angles and
no.
all of that.
So that then you could shoot. We could shoot a four-page scene in an hour if we absolutely had to.
Well, what about the location shooting? I mean, you were born and raised in Norway, so you're used to snow. But that looked to me like one hellacious location to shoot.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I mean, we were driving around all over the west coast area of Norway with like a caravan of 10, 12 cars. One would make, you know, all the usual elements. And we would just, and it would be traversing through areas with huge, with snow and ice. And it was times kind of crazy. I remember once the driver of the troll hunter's car, we were going downhill and it was icy, and he was sitting with the door open in case the car started sliding. He was going to be able to jump out. It was like, it was so crazy.
What was the most challenging part of that for you?
I mean, we did 3 weeks on the road like that to shoot in a real location.
Oh, it's miserable to shoot on the road.
Yeah. And we were just like, and to organize, you know, this hotels and that kind of stuff is a huge thing. Obviously, I wasn't involved with that, but it's a big job to even be able to do it. And then we went back to Oslo, and then we shot all the forest scenes that didn't really need the huge locations.
Right, right.
And a few interiors, and yeah.
So you finished your first feature film. You'd been making your living as a filmmaker, doing commercials and videos and things. So now you've got a movie, and suddenly... film festivals want to play it, and you're starting to get reaction. Tell me the feeling of going into a theater full of an audience that fills a theater at a film festival and is loving your movie.
I mean, I remember we had one screening before we left Oslo our first screening of the movie was a public screening of the movie was at Fantastic Fest.
Ah, great. In the UK. Yeah.
No, in the US. Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, the one in London. Yeah.
So it was such a local movie, and it was dealing with such local themes and local lore in a way. And the first people who were going to see it were basically Texans and right. and in the national and international audience. And we were like terrified. What if they don't understand anything of what we're trying to do? All the jokes are meant for a Norwegian audience.
Right.
In a tone, and then
so nobody'd seen it at home yet.
Nobody seen it, not even the distributor. Not nobody.
Wow,
It was insane. We were so we went to Texas and we showed it. And I remember we sat there for the whole night, like wondering how people reacted. Really, extremely well in the theater, but you don't really know because it's a warm environment.
Right, right.
More than anything, it's a warm, wonderful environment.
Yeah, but a festival audience will let you know if they're going to hold their noses. You know?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but they were like, okay. And then I started hearing, oh, we're setting up special screenings throughout the night.
Wow.
Like in the middle of the night, like 2 a.m. or something for various important VIP people.
Right.
I think they had a specific one for Harry Knowles. That was, I believe. And it was like, okay, what's going on now? And then suddenly tweets started coming out. It was still in the early days of Twitter. And then it was suddenly overnight, it was all over that it was giving all the critics.
So there's
who were there.
Buzz.
Yeah, there was like this buzz building throughout the night until the morning. And then suddenly they started giving 9 out of 10 on the reviews. And it was like, right. Oh my God, okay.
That had to be an exciting feeling.
Yeah, and then the distributors all over started calling the producer about getting a hold of it. And Tom Quinn from Magnolia at the time came up to me at the screening, actually, and said, I want to buy our movie. Mm-hmm. Well, and then it was a negotiations and all kinds of amazing stuff going on over the next few days.
So this was followed up. Did you go to a bunch of festivals then after that and play it around the world?
Yeah. And then, then we had a whole bunch of festivals. And then the real actual premiere became at Sundance because that was the film was still not finished when we showed it at Fantastic Fest.
Oh, so it still qualified as a premiere at Sundance.
Yeah. That's great, which was fantastic. So then we had our whole new thing there, and it was really well received there as well. So it was just like, you know, an amazing experience.
So what were the things offered to you off of this? You probably got a lot of people coming to you with either found footage or giant monster movies.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, horror, found footage, and to a degree monster movies, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was definitely it. So I got a ton of that. And then... but didn't really figure it out, and none of the projects were really like properly financed. So we were attached myself to a few of them.
Right.
The biggest one was actually, which is still like a big wound in my career, is a movie called Carpe Demon, written by Chris Columbus and the Hageman brothers, who also wrote Scary Stories.
Oh, interesting. Well, the circle closes.
An amazing circle there, because I was attached to direct that for the longest time. And Chris Columbus bought the rights for the remake together with a company called CG Entertainment. And it was such an, that was amazing to even meet one of my idols.
Sure.
And he wanted to...
you mean you like Gremlins?
Yeah. So it was, it was a whirlwind there.
Well, what about the idea of a remake? I remember for a while Neil Marshall was attached, and he was talking to Harrison Ford about playing the lead in this. Were you involved at the time, or were you hearing rumors off to the side? Because suddenly Troll Hunter isn't just this Norwegian movie.
No, that was amazing. I mean, I didn't really know anything about it, what was going on. I also heard... Harrison Ford, I heard other big names of actors that were, in theory, attached to it for a moment. But the movie never, in a way, materialized, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So...
Well, we only need one Troll Hunters. You did it right.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah.
And so how did Autopsy of Jane Doe come about from that?
So I started developing a movie called Mortal with Brian Kavanagh-Jones and Ben Pugh at a company called 42 in London. It was like a Norwegian movie about another Norwegian movie about Norwegian mythology. And then a friend of mine at WME sent me a script called The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and he said, you have to read it. And I didn't really have time, so I didn't get to read it for like weeks. And he was like, you have to read it. They're looking for directors. Your name is not on that list. It should be. And I was like, okay, well, let me read it then. And I sat for 45 minutes and I read through it overnight, and it was terrifying.
Yeah,
I was like, holy Moses. And I had just come out of seeing The Conjuring, which was so inspiring because it was such a... It was a film that was not following the, at the time, found footage genre. It was like a proper Hollywood movie, horror movie, like the ones I grew up with.
A narrative film.
Yeah. Yes, and really like classically told. And it was so well constructed. It was so inspiring. And it showed that horror, the horror genre can really thrive again with just like doing solid classical filmmaking and not having to experiment with the genre. And it was very, so I've, okay, well, that, the connection of those, the, those two events led me to say, okay, let me talk to the producers. And they were all, I was already in theory working with them on Mortal, or at least half of the producers. And they felt, they loved my pitch, and suddenly I'm there attached to it. And that was 2013. And then it took 2 years with a whole bunch of casting issues to get it off the ground, because we had Martin Sheen originally.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Brian Cox is so perfect.
Oh yeah,
so perfect. So you, the scope of Troll Hunter, regardless of the budget, was huge. The scope was giant, and the characters were giant. And The Autopsy of Jane Doe is exactly the opposite. It's incredibly claustrophobic. It all takes place in one place, and it is so haunting. Tell me about how you went about planning. How it, what the style was going to be, what the approach was going to be, because it's a very unified feeling film. It feels choreographed despite the tiny scope of it.
Yeah, no, we really, I mean, the challenge I found to be able to make a movie in a closed environment like that is you have to vary it. You have to find each scene has to be shot in a different way. So it has a, so you feel, and also we created a DOP, and we created a, an evolution in the style throughout the film. So it was gonna be, so it would in a way feel like there is an evolution, even though the space is the same. We would start with one set of lenses, and then we would transition to another set of section of the lens range at the midpoint of the film, and to, so we basically had to make space that initially felt warm and inviting and known for the characters would suddenly become unknown and frightening. The same space, walking through the hallway in the beginning should not feel like walking through the hallway in the late part of the movie. So you could sense the environment, and I was very preoccupied with just having environment. So we would shoot everything on wide lenses. You know, we would essentially stay in the 20 to 40 through the movie. And so we always have environment, and I really believe that's part of horror in general, to relate the physical space to the characters.
Right. Well, it's beautifully composed. It's beautifully done. But the experience, now you're working with a name actor, an internationally renowned actor for the first time. Did you find that intimidating at all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in theory, I mean, of course, I'd known about both Emil Hirsch and Brian Cox are amazing actors.
Absolutely.
So, A, I was super lucky to, I knew I could lean on them for tense, important moments. I knew I had the best professionals I could ever have. And then, but at the same time, yeah, it's intimidating. I remember I was terrified meeting Brian the first time. But he was so nice. He was so welcoming and so inviting. And then he was so professional on the shoot. He was, you know, he knew everything, and he would nail it on the first take. They both would. And the only thing, it was just a luxury. I would just sometimes just, that's fantastic. Let's just do another take. And they would go at it again. And it was actually even better because they would refine their, they would instinctively know what they could do better. I didn't have to tell them. It was amazing to watch. Okay, at that moment, it didn't quite land. And then they just naturally did it better, if you will, the second take. And we, after four takes, we were usually done.
So did you find that they kind of worked in the same way? They fed off of each other? I know some actors want more direction. Some actors want to be left alone. And because of the very small size of the cast, that, you know, working together with two actors scene after scene, I just wonder what that process was like for you.
No, Brian, obviously, he's done so much.
Yeah.
He doesn't really need a director. I mean, honestly, he knows what he's doing. Emil, too. I mean, but Emil and I would have more conversations about things. And of course, we would talk. I mean, Brian and I talked a lot throughout the process of what to do next and how to do the scenes. But in the end, it is their performance. It is right. not my direction that creates exactly. that performance. It really is. I'm just guiding them a little bit.
Well, this was new for you in that you had written your first film. And now here you're working from somebody else's script. How did that feel different to you? How did it impact your work as a director in that regard?
I mean, I actually really love working on other people's scripts because I get just the perfect distance to it where I'm not precious over everything. I can actually analyze it. And obviously, when you choose a movie, it's almost like choosing a life partner. It's truly is a... you have to love the script in the first place. I would never make a movie if I didn't love the script.
Right.
So so the script was great from the get-go, and then it feels like I don't know. It feels more. I can also trust the writer's work. I know that I can see it on a page that is good.
Right, heavy lifting's been done for you in that regard.
And I don't have to be responsible for that, even though, of course, you tweak and you work and da da da. But
your job is then to bring it to life.
Yeah, and
I
love that job.
It already exists, but now you bring it to life with human beings. So they're very different processes. Writing is a very solitary process, and directing is the exact opposite of that. Do you have a preference, or are they all part of the same machine?
I mean, I love writing, but I don't really have time for it anymore. Yeah. I mean, after Jane Doe, it's become luxury to have those months that it takes to write a script.
So those were two independent movies, and suddenly the gears have shifted, and Scary Stories in the Dark comes about. How did that come about for you?
I was working with Jason Brown and Sean Daniel, two of the producers.
I worked with Sean when I was writing The Mummy. Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, he's fantastic.
Well, not The Mummy that got made.
No, I know you.
Was still a horror movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you were involved with it earlier.
Sean was great. Really, a great producer, yeah. So you're working with him.
Yeah, I was working with them on a movie that eventually didn't go. And then 6 months later, suddenly they slipped me a script and they say, Guillermo was supposed to direct this. He might not. You want to read it? And I was like, okay. And Guillermo already likes you, so because he had tweeted about Jane Doe like 6-8 months before.
Oh, great.
The same week that Stephen King did it.
Yeah, so. You got knighted twice.
It was crazy, yeah. And then I read the script, and it was by the Hageman brothers, who had also written Carpe Diem with Chris Columbus, and I immediately just loved it. It was like an Amblin movie, like you obviously know very well.
Yeah.
It was a horror Amblin movie. And that's how I pitched it to the studio.
That's
and I pitched
great.
It to everybody. And that's the take I want to do. And it was such a beautiful story of coming of age with all these kids. And one wonderful set piece after the other. And it was all tied together so beautifully with the way the stories are from the books, and it was just a dream scenario to be able to get to make that this movie for me.
Did the process of working with a studio rear its head as something different from the beginning, or because you had the 800-pound gorilla that is Guillermo del Toro producing, did that protect you from that, or did you find yourself surrounded by more input than you were used to?
No, I mean, that's the thing. When I grew up, well, my professional career was growing up in the commercial industry. So there you have to deal with agencies and you have to deal with clients and you have to make a movie for a bunch of people. And you have conversations, creative conversations with everybody, including people who don't really know the process of making a movie. Mm-hmm. And so you're quite used to dealing with all these things. And that really, I think, helped me prepare for that process. But CBS has been amazing. I mean, Terry Press has been amazing. She's been so supportive for the whole throughout. And obviously, yes, there is a thing about having Guillermo del Toro producing.
The Godfather, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's it has definitely been a huge support throughout. He's been amazing, and he's an awe-inspiring person.
Well, just people don't realize what a brilliant artist he is. I mean, painting and drawing as well as filmmaking and writing.
Yeah, no, his movies are beautiful. They have an identity that are just unique to him and will stand in film history forever. And it's in addition, he's such a smart storyteller. We had like weeks where we're sitting in basically a writer's room with the writers and him and me and a couple of the producers, and to tweak the script before we went into production. And it was just an amazing experience. I mean, his knowledge of storytelling and understanding of character and detail and themes and fitting everything together and making themes come alive in specific little details was a masterclass for me.
I worked with him briefly. He asked me to produce Don't Be Afraid of the Dark before it fell apart when it was a part of the Disney Miramax fall-apart time. And he's just such a brilliant guy and a sweet guy.
Yeah.
And just amazing to work with. And I know this will reflect his personality, but tell me how it felt. It reflects your personality as a filmmaker, too. What do you think that personally you brought to this movie?
I mean, Guillermo says, and I can only quote him on that, that I'm able to make a horror movie with a heart. Mm. I'm not a vicious horror filmmaker, which some are. You know, I don't know if they're vicious, but the movies can be quite vicious. To reach the height of intense horror, sometimes you have to be vicious. But I try to bring a warmth to the films, and I think that's what he wanted as well. And obviously, his movies are filled with that warmth.
Absolutely, they're bordering on sentimental in a good way.
Yeah.
So, did you tap into this? Is a film about childhood and what scares you as a child? Did it bring you around to nostalgic feelings of your own childhood fears?
Yeah, I mean, the movie is, you know, is based on these children's books, and it's all about making all these little stories come alive. And they're so, you know, they're so international in their structure, stories. They're very easy to understand for anybody and to appreciate for anybody. You know, and also the scenes as written in the script were, you know, you immediately recognize running, crawling under the bed and hearing the monster and all these very classical scenarios that are nightmares for kids.
Speaking of nightmares, do you dream?
I do, but I barely remember them.
Yeah. So when you were a kid, are there fears that you had that are reflected in this new movie?
I mean, yeah, I think the way I depict a scene will probably come from how I fear it. I would experience it.
Right.
But the scene itself is obviously somebody else's construction. Somebody else wrote it.
Right.
But the way I projected it onto a screen, in a way, will be based on, yeah.
When you were a kid, do you remember what the first scary movie you saw as a child?
The first scary movie. Oh, God, I don't really.
Or one that had a particular effect on you. I know we talked about The Omen, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, the one that really scared me, I don't know how old I was Poltergeist.
Yeah.
The tree outside that, and the doll, and he's just sitting there counting down from the
seconds for the thunder.
Yeah, just that was so real.
Yeah.
And because I grew up in an area with a lot of bad weather, so I could totally relate to that.
I was lucky enough to be on the set for a couple of those scenes, and it was pretty amazing watching that come together. Who are the filmmakers who inspire you?
I mean, when I grew up, for sure, Steven Spielberg is like easily by far my number one.
Yeah.
And then you have Robert Zemeckis and Joe Dante and all these people.
The Amblin crowd.
Yeah, the Amblin crowd. I mean, Amblin movies where I would, you know, watch them again and again and again and again, all these movies.
And are there other artistic forms that you are a part of? Do you play an instrument? Have you made music? Do you draw?
I used to draw quite a bit, but then I put it away, and now I can't draw worth anything. But when I was a kid, I drew a lot. I drew cartoons and all kinds of stuff, and I was fairly decent. So if I, but now
I used to do that too until I started writing at 12, and then that kind of replaced it. And I got my first little movie camera at 12 as well, an 8mm camera. So that kind of changed the course of my life. Not that I ever thought I'd make a living doing it, and lucky us.
No, we're just insanely lucky.
Yeah. I mean, What do you think you would be doing if you weren't able to have a film career?
I don't know. I always wanted to be an astronaut.
Really?
When I was a kid. I don't think I probably wouldn't be, but it's a even more select group of people than being a director.
Outside of the horror genre, what are some of the films and filmmakers that have inspired you?
I mean, of course, Guillermo del Toro is a huge inspiration. Yeah. The way he shoots scenes and with the beauty of everything he does and the performances he gets out of his actors are amazing.
But even non-genre stuff, maybe something that... What would be films that you like that would surprise people that you like them?
I mean, one of my favorite movies is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm-hmm. I watched that numerous times, endless amount of times. I love 70s thrillers. So, I mean, like my all-time favorite movie is Close Encounters.
Oh, wow.
And I love All the President's Men. I can watch that obsessively.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a movie, a bunch of people on the phone, in a way. Right. But I mean, my God, it's so exciting.
What is your process when you're taking on a movie, the script is written, how do you start breaking it down? Do you storyboard everything? Do you shot list? How do you set out to make an Andre Overdahl film?
The worst process for me is actually the very first time I read a script. I can spend weeks procrastinating reading a script because the process is basically a day or two's work to read through it, because every thought I have as I'm reading it the very first time, I want to write down the emotional reaction, because that's when I watch the movie the first time,
right?
And I will never get it back. Second time is analysis, third time is breaking it down. So the first, so that becomes a huge thing. And but then, you know, no, I mean, when it comes to shooting, when it comes to preparing it, I shot list. I make overhead, like plan view, plan view. Some scenes you obviously have to storyboard. Usually it's so hurried, it's so rushed into production. The storyboard is such a meticulous, long-winded process, and back and forth with the artist and da-da-da-da.
Yeah, if you can't be sitting with the artist, and who has the time to do that, it becomes so difficult. You don't want to just hand over a scene and say, here.
Oh, no. I'm obsessive about the camera angles.
Yeah, every single shot.
I would drive the drawers nuts. Because it's lower. It's 10 inches lower. The camera is going 10 inches lower. So you have to drive, yeah.
So let's say it's Saturday before you start shooting on Monday. What's your process?
I mean, this ideally I would rest.
Yeah. So you've done all your prep, you're ready. Yeah,
ideally. But I mean, like on Scary Stories, we had a bit of, you know, we didn't have enough time to prepare every day because we had to like almost improvise a bunch of the scenes. So the DOP and I would meet at 4 a.m. in the morning before the shooting day starts. We'd sit for 3 hours and we would prepare the shot list for the day. And walk through the plan view together, and then hand it out to everybody like an hour before the shoot start, even half an hour before the shoot start.
Wow!
So everybody's like, "Oh, we're gonna be over there." Okay.
What is a kind of movie that you haven't made that you would like to make? I mean, would you want to do a Western? Would you want to do a legal thriller? Would you want to do a romance?
I mean,
a puppet movie.
I mean, a big adventure film. You know, Indiana Jones would be amazing. Star Wars would be amazing. Something like that would be. But those are,
What
far-fetched.
Do you think it is about your background, your Scandinavian upbringing, that maybe is reflected in the films that you make?
I think that there is a groundedness to what I do. I love the idea of making spectacular events on screen that are basically unreal, but do it in as grounded a way as possible. And in many ways, Troll Hunter is the extreme version of that, because you're insisting everything is real with a documentary camera,
right.
But it's about ridiculous big trolls with long noses. So the contrast is the biggest there. But I think also on Jane, and especially on Scary Stories, it's about trying to stick to a very grounded level attitude. And that's where you begin, is always with the characters and actors.
Right. So what about making a film for kids? You know, you're taking a known property, IP, as everyone likes to say, that maybe people grew up with. People in their 30s are probably as much the target audience as the younger kids who are reading the books for the first time. So what was your approach on tackling this kind of material that's already familiar?
I mean, I love the challenge of that. I mean, again, like with the next movie, with the Stephen King movie, I love the challenge of having to live up to somebody's expectations in a way. And when you have the entire American population having grown up with these books, you can't really get more expectations.
Right.
In a way. So there is a fear that drives that, that is exciting in a way. I don't know.
Did you have to keep things in mind? Did you have to be careful knowing that, I assume this is a PG-13, right?
Yeah.
Were there things that you had to be cautious of because you knew you were restricted by that rating?
No, I mean, I never saw that rating as a restriction whatsoever.
Ah.
I mean, my goal was to make the scariest movie I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really think we've done. I mean, I've seen the audience scream at the theater in test screenings in pure fear for the characters. So it seems to work really well.
Well, let's talk about Stephen King, because that's your next movie. The Long Walk, as long as I've been doing Stephen King stuff, I've had at least 100 people say to me, you know, The Long Walk, that should be a Stephen King movie. I've got a great script of The Long Walk. You know, King wrote that story when he was 19 years old. And it's an incredible story. So tell me about how you have come into the world of Stephen King.
I mean, I grew up with reading his books. I read all his original, you know, all those 70s books when I was in my teens. And I just completely fell in love with him. I would devour one book a day, which is kind of today when I've spent, it's really, I can't believe I could even read that much. So I have loved his novels all my life. And then The Long Walk comes along, like it's almost a year and a half ago since I first read the script.
Mm-hmm.
And
who wrote the script?
James Vanderbilt.
Ah.
And he wrote it on spec, basically, because he loves the book so much.
Yeah.
And
there are probably 100 spec scripts of The Long Walk out there, at least.
Yeah.
But fantastic. So now King had already let it be known that he was a big fan of Autopsy of Jane Doe. So did that have anything to do with them coming to you? Because I assume if he's an executive producer, it's from a distance.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, I don't even know if he's, obviously I'm assuming he must be aware that I'm directing it.
He is. Yeah.
But I haven't had the opportunity to speak with him myself, obviously.
Right.
But the, no, I mean, he's, no, sorry, what was the question?
Well, just wondering about how it came about, your connection to this. Was it just a script that your agent brought to you that they're thinking of Andre Overdahl would be the perfect guy
for
this?
Yeah, I mean, and also I think they see the connection. I think they saw New Line and Brad Fisher, the producer, and my agents for that matter, saw the connection between The Autopsy of Jane Doe and The Long Walk, which is that it's kind of a chamber play mm-hmm. in a way, with characters just in
even
a
though it's on the road instead
it's
of
it's still
enclosed.
A very confined space.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
That's you have that area.
It's a short story. It's a long short story, but how do you envision that as a feature film? There had to have been some liberties taken to expand the story a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, not much liberties. I mean, I think that the script is really a fantastic representation of what the book is. I think so. What can I say publicly?
Well, we don't want you to give anything away, but yeah. But you feel that it's a pretty representative feature film adaptation. I know when I did Riding the Bullet, there was a 30-page short story, and half of that movie is just invention that wasn't there, but with the full support of King, which was awfully nice to have.
I imagine, yeah.
So what? Who did you read when you were growing up? I mean, obviously King. Did you read Richard Matheson, Clive Barker, other horror, or was you
entertained? Yeah, Ray Bradbury and all this. Yeah, absolutely. But I have to admit, I didn't read that much. I have to say I watched more movies than I read.
Yeah.
But I did read a lot of, I read Jules Verne. I read a lot of stuff like that. Fantastic tales in a way.
Who is no longer with us in the world of film, do you wish you had met?
I mean, Orson Welles, Stanley Kubrick, those are huge inspirations and seem like very fascinating people.
What are the films that would be your tropical desert island films that you'd want to have maybe three films with you that were the only ones you could watch over and over and over?
Probably an Indiana Jones film, Close Encounters, and maybe Die Hard or Seven. Or
Okay. Just one non-Amblin movie. Non-Spielberg thing. So. Well, listen, Andre, this has just been a total delight, and I'm really excited to see the film. This will probably be out there once the film opens, but I love your work, and so many other people do that have opened doors to you doing even bigger and better, and I'm really excited for you, and it's great to watch the trajectory of your career.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on here. Been a huge fan of yours for my whole life, so I'm very honored to be here.
Well, it's an honor for me too, and good luck with the movie, and I know it's going to be great and everything beyond. So thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would let the world know about it by reviewing and rating it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you have comments or questions for our Ask Mick Anything shows, send them to producer Joe at Joe Russo Tweets or to at Mick Garris PM on Instagram or Twitter or the Postmortem with Mick Garris Facebook page. This is a brand new address, so don't forget it. That's at Mick Garris PM on both Twitter and Instagram. And if you'd like to see my vintage and recent video interviews, making of documentaries, and audiobooks of some of my short stories, go to my website, mickgarrisinterviews.com.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.